Today is Tuesday, January 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia and the U.S. remain far apart after talks aimed at diffusing tensions over Ukraine.
I don't think you will expect me saying otherwise than to confirm that this is one of the areas where we have the greatest difference of views with the U.S.
Democrats mount a bid to move ahead on stalled legislation to overhaul American elections.
From President Biden down, top Democrats seized on last week's Capitol insurrection anniversary to push their long-stalled package. One Senate leader, Chuck Schumer, says is needed to ward off another attack on democracy.
And aid agencies cease operations in Ethiopia's Tigray region after an airstrike late Friday that killed scores of civilians. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russia and the U.S. remain far apart after talks on Monday aimed at defusing tensions over Ukraine. Moscow insisted on guarantees to halt NATO's eastward expansion and even roll back the military alliance's deployment in Eastern Europe, and Washington firmly rejected the demands as a non-starter. With both sides dug in on their positions, Russia Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov said, quote, "No progress was made on the central demand to halt NATO expansion," unquote. He spoke after 5.5 hours of talks with his U.S. counterpart, Wendy Sherman.
I don't think you will expect me saying otherwise than to confirm that this is one of the areas where we have the greatest difference of views with the U.S. The U.S. suggests that there is no way that Russia or whoever else may have a say on those type of issues. But we underscore that for us it's absolutely mandatory to make sure that Ukraine never, never, ever becomes member of NATO. Peter Baker's piece and op-ed in today's New York Times, where it is said that, essentially it is said that Russia wants to trade its quote-unquote threat against Ukraine for more flexibility on the part of U.S. and the West at those talks. But this is not the case, because we have no intention to invade Ukraine. We need ironclad, waterproof, bulletproof, legally binding guarantees, not assurances, not safeguards, guarantees with all the words shall, must, everything that should be put in this bold, never ever becoming member of NATO.
That's Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov. The meeting was part of a flurry of diplomatic activity in Europe this week over a Russian military buildup on the border with Ukraine with an estimated 100,000 troops. Michelle Quinn reports.
The situation, which has been brewing for years, escalated in recent weeks with a troop buildup. Russia has denied it plans to invade its neighbor and demanded that NATO forces pull back from Eastern Europe as part of security guarantees. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said there is room for negotiation. Reducing American troops in the region is not on the table, but he said other issues are, such as reviving a treaty that placed mutual limits on where troops can be deployed and conduct exercises. Blinken, however, added there would likely be no breakthroughs in the first talks, given what is happening on the ground. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke on ABC's This Week.
To make actual progress, it's very hard to see that happening when there's an ongoing escalation, when Russia has a gun to the head of Ukraine with 100,000 troops near its borders, the possibility of doubling that on very short order.
Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov told Russian news agency Sunday that there might not be much progress in the talks because the United States lacks an understanding of Russia's security concerns. Since Russia crossed Ukraine's border and annexed Crimea 8 years ago, tensions between Moscow and Kyiv have been high. Ukraine is a former Soviet republic. While a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine called on the U.S. to send more troops to the Eastern European nation, Republican Senator Mike Rounds said he supports the Biden administration's efforts to find a diplomatic solution with Russian President Vladimir Putin. He spoke on ABC's This Week.
And I think sending a message to Mr. Putin that he's going to get a lot more accomplished using diplomatic means rather than threatening to invade is something that we should be very, very firm about.
Secretary Blinken said there are principles bigger than Ukraine in play, such as not allowing one nation to change borders by force or to subjugate its neighbors.
That's why it's so important that we stand not only for Ukraine's territorial integrity, its sovereignty, and its independence, but for these basic principles.
After officials meet in Geneva, they are expected to continue talks this week in Brussels and Vienna. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Democrats are mounting a passionate bid this week to move ahead on legislation to overhaul American elections and are considering changing Senate rules to overcome GOP opposition. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
From President Biden down, top Democrats seized on last week's Capitol insurrection anniversary to push their long-stalled package. One Senate leader, Chuck Schumer, says is needed to ward off another attack on democracy.
There's no better way to heal the damage of January 6th.
But GOP Chief Mitch McConnell argues invoking the insurrection to push a left-wing agenda is offensive.
It is beyond distasteful.
And the legislation's not needed. Schumer says the evenly split Senate will consider lowering the 60-vote threshold for passing most legislation, though even some Democrats are wary of that. The president's due to give a voting rights speech tomorrow in Atlanta after visiting Martin Luther King Jr.'s burial site. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Aid agencies have ceased operations in the northwest area of Ethiopia's Tigray region near the border with Eritrea. This after an airstrike there late Friday killed scores of civilians displaced by the conflict. Chidimo Dewit reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, said Sunday that aid groups have suspended their operations in northwest Tigray. Humanitarian partners suspended activities in the area due to the ongoing threats of drone strikes, said the statement to the media. Reuters news agency quoted aid workers saying an airstrike late Friday on a camp near the Eritrean border killed 56 people and wounded 30 others. The UN humanitarian office told the AFP news agency that the attack in the town of Debita has caused scores of civilian casualties. The Tigray People's Liberation Front, the party that has ruled Tigray for decades, condemned the attack. In a statement Saturday, the TPLF accused the Ethiopian government of targeting civilians. It also accused Eritrean forces of attacking Tigrayan fighters in the northwest Tigray on the same day the IDP camp was hit. Ethiopia's federal authorities did not immediately comment on the accusations or the UN announcement on the aid group's withdrawal. But since the outbreak of the war with the Tigrayan rebels in November 2020, authorities have denied targeting civilians. The UN has been warning of worsening humanitarian situation in Tigray. The UN Humanitarian Office said last week that humanitarian agencies operating in Tigray have only one-sixth the amount of fuel needed to distribute limited food aid. It said they continue to face security, bureaucratic, and operational challenges, with aid partners forced to reduce or suspend operations, leaving millions of people without access to life-saving assistance. Gelmo Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The dry season in Central Africa sees a great southward migration of Chadian and Sudanese cattle herders into the Central African Republic in search of water and pasture. But the tens of thousands of livestock crossing farmlands leads to conflict between herders and farmers. Carol Villard reports from Paoa in the Central African Republic.
Fulani herder Mohamed Ali Gaga's only source of income is his cattle, but they are too skinny and quickly losing value. During the dry season, from December to March, he must travel hundreds of kilometers to find water, greener pasture, and to reach southern cattle markets. But the journey is fraught with danger, as the Central African Republic has been in conflict since 2013. Today we're stuck, says Ali Gaga. If we travel further, we will come across rebels and be subjected to extortion, he says. But if we stay too close to the villages, adds Ali Gaga, farmers will chase us to protect the land. Farmer Janvier Biensona holds a broken stalk of cassava on parts of his trampled crops. For power-based farmers like him, the nomadic herders are a menace as their cattle eat and destroy crops.
A
herd was definitely here, says Biensona. You can see the damage. To lessen the damage, he says, they usually try to harvest the fields before the seasonal migration starts. Biensona says nomadic herders are destroying everything. Some farmers accuse the herders of supporting the rebels who are also ethnic Fulani. After men in the town of Zereke stole some cattle in December, aid groups say herders sought help from the rebel group 3R. 3R, which stands for Return, Reclamation and Rehabilitation, attacked the town and burned scores of houses. The International Organization for Migration provides photos showing what's left of the village, scattered personal belongings among ashes. The IOM regional office head, Amadou Traoré, fears the farmer-herder conflict will only worsen.
Les couloirs ne sont pas, les transhumants ne sont pas respectés.
Migration corridors are not respected anymore, he says. When cattle herders are crossing farmers' land, says Traoré, conflict arises between them. He says there are houses being burned, attacks and killings. Despite the rebels siding with herders for revenge attacks, herders maintain they are also victims of the rebels. The National Central African Herders Federation, Kadiri Gagaz, rejects any collaboration. How can we partner with armed groups that already plunder our livestock, he asks. Garba says cattle herders only want safety. If there is no safety, he says, then they will flee toward Chad or other regions. In the village of Ben Nkuma, a power-based mediation group known by its acronym, CASAL, is struggling to lower tensions. CASAL's Tebo Wafio says the objective is to avoid revenge attacks between farmers and herders or assumed links to the rebels.
La persécution est reposée beaucoup plus sur les éleveurs.
Herders are far more persecuted than farmers, he says. The herders are frightened, Wafio says, and some have already left the prefecture. He says it's very painful for them. Their work as mediators was starting to bear fruits, and then they say it's all blown away. Despite communal crashes, Wafio is optimistic he can make a difference. The nomadic Fulani herders listen to him because he's a fellow Muslim, he says, and the farmers listen to him because he's a local. Carole Valade for VOA News, Bawa, Central African Republic.
Somali leaders have agreed to conclude the long-delayed parliamentary and presidential elections by February 25th. Somalia's international partners have welcomed the deal, while a political standoff between the president and prime minister has some Somalis still skeptical. Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu.
According to Mohamed Ibrahim Maalimu, the spokesman of the prime minister, all involved in the electoral process should respect the rules in order to move forward. He says, in order to safeguard the close coordination of the electoral body, the National Consultative Council calls upon various levels of the poll management agency to respect the rules and regulations as per existing electoral agreements. He added that the council retaliates respect for 30% quota of seats to be held for women in the ongoing process. The indirect polls was supposed to be held more than a year ago, but were delayed by disputes over how they will be conducted. More recently, President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed and Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble have been at odds over election procedures, heightening the political tensions. Residents of the capital, Mogadishu, who witnessed tensions linked to electoral impasse, have welcomed the deal. Liban Mohamed says the new agreement reached is great, because it brings together both Somali leadership and the people, and they pray for its successive implementation. However, many analysts are skeptical about the deal, especially the timeline. Omar Abdullah is a political analyst and lecturer of political science and international relations at Simad University in Mogadishu. He said the deal is generally welcomed, but it will face three main challenges, including the timeline set to conclude parliamentary polls within 45 days. Secondly, the dispute resolution committee, where the difference between the president and prime minister started. And thirdly, the agreement does not make it clear who will select tribal leaders, which will result in conflict later. The UN office in Somalia has urged Somali leaders to avoid provocations that risk new tensions and stay focused on delivering a credible electoral process quickly for the benefit of all. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
A court in military-ruled Myanmar has sentenced ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi to 4 years in jail on several charges, including possession of unlicensed walkie-talkies, a source familiar with the proceedings said. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
Myanmar's former leader Aung San Suu Kyi was sentenced to a further 4 years in jail on Monday. That's according to a source familiar with proceedings. Suu Kyi was found guilty of several charges, including possession of unlicensed walkie-talkies and breaching the natural disaster management law related to coronavirus rules. The Nobel laureate is on trial in nearly a dozen cases that carry combined maximum sentences of more than 100 years in prison. She denies all charges. Her supporters say the cases against her are baseless and designed to end her political career while the military consolidates power. Myanmar has been in turmoil since a coup last February, when Suu Kyi's democratically elected government was overthrown, sparking widespread protests. Suu Kyi was detained the same day as the coup, and days after, a police document said six illegally imported walkie-talkies were found during a search of her home. Her trial has been closed to the media, and her lawyers have been barred from communicating with the press and public.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. In other news, authorities in Kazakhstan say police have detained nearly 8,000 people during protests that descended into violence last week and marked the worst unrest the former Soviet nation has faced since gaining independence 30 years ago. Kazakhstan's Interior Ministry says that 7,939 people have been detained across the country. The National Security Committee, Kazakhstan's anti-terrorism agency, says that the situation in the country has, quote, stabilized, unquote. The demonstrations began over a near doubling of fuel prices and quickly spread across the country, reflecting wider discontent with Kazakhstan's authoritarian rule. The health ministry says 164 people, including three children, were killed in the unrest. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Despite having the highest number of COVID infections in Africa nearly 2 years into the pandemic, fewer than half of South African adults have been vaccinated. South Africa's government has been reluctant to order vaccine mandates, but private companies are stepping in to encourage people to get the jab. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
Thousands of COVID-19 vaccination sites have opened across South Africa, but the flow of patients is stalled. From the peak of over 1 million vaccines administered in 1 week in August, numbers have plummeted to under 150,000 last week. The decline comes as the country fell far short of the government target to inoculate 67% of the population by the end of 2021. Florence Mosiani is the operation manager of the Parkhurst Clinic in Johannesburg. She says dispelling misinformation could encourage more people to get their shot.
Providing more health education to our community. Or why vaccinate, what is the importance of vaccinations. Education, giving more information will assist, will reduce those kinds of resistance and myths about the vaccine.
Companies are taking steps beyond public education. Discovery is the largest private health insurer in South Africa. The company encouraged vaccination of its clients by offering rewards points and cash back on life insurance premiums. In September, Discovery also mandated that its 11,000 employees be vaccinated, and the policy worked. Staff vaccination rates jumped from 22% to 94% within 3 months. Dr. Ronald Whelan is the chief commercial officer at Discovery Health and heads the company's COVID-19 task team.
Discovery is well-versed and has done extensive work over the years around the behavioral psychology and incentives and rewards for getting people to behave in particular ways and supporting those behavioral changes. But those behavioral changes only get you to a certain point. Once you start getting to the 70% thresholds, you need firmer levers to get people over the finish line.
Whelan said employees overwhelmingly welcome the mandate and the reassurance it brings for going back to work. But he said 2-3% of employees have remained resistant. As more companies introduce similar policies, legal battles have been raised, arguing it infringes on individual rights. The country is still waiting to see how the courts will rule on the issue. Safura Abdul-Karim is a public health lawyer in South Africa.
We know from previous cases during the pandemic that these competing community rights to life and health weigh extremely heavily and can warrant the infringement of individual rights in certain situations, but particularly in the context of a pandemic as serious as COVID-19. So it is very likely that vaccine mandates will be found to be constitutional in South Africa.
Without faster uptake, the country's hard-won vaccine supply will expire. In November, the government asked Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, as well as the U.S. government, to delay sending more vials. The same month, President Cyril Ramaphosa warned widespread mandates were being considered. Abdul-Karim says the government should have already brought in stronger mandates.
We've reached a point where our supply of vaccines outstrips the demand for them. So we need to get that demand back up so that we ensure that all the vaccines we have at our disposal are utilized and that we reach that goal of population-level immunity.
She says mandates can play a strong role in increasing vaccination rates if other barriers like transportation to clinics and time off work are tackled as well. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Undocumented Afghan migrants who have fled to Turkey to escape the Taliban say they are not able to access treatment and vaccines for COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. While officially registered refugees do qualify for health care in Turkey, it's believed there are thousands of unregistered Afghan migrants in the country. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Erzurum in central Turkey is on a major route for migrants heading west to Europe. It's a stopover for many Afghan refugees. Some settle here and find work. According to official United Nations figures, Turkey is hosting around 183,000 Afghan asylum seekers. But unofficial estimates suggest thousands more Afghan migrants are undocumented, living and working in Turkey under the radar and unable to access basic services like healthcare. Mohammed is among them. He told VOA, "I am from Badakhshan province in Afghanistan. I came to Turkey 2 months ago. I am 18 years old. We have no ID cards, so the hospitals don't treat us." Mohammed works in a local dairy company, along with several other Afghan migrants in Erzurum, including Islam. He told VOA there are 8 or 9 people living in this room. 5 people have ID cards and the rest don't. If any of those who don't have an ID card catches coronavirus, the hospitals don't treat them. Those who have no ID card cannot have a vaccine. If they catch coronavirus, we will all catch coronavirus. Several Afghan migrants told VOA they choose not to register as official refugees, fearing arrest and deportation. Many said the status of Afghan refugees remains unclear, and they want clarification from the Turkish government. Turkey has ramped up border security and detained hundreds of Afghan migrants in deportation centres. The Turkish government did not respond to VOA questions on the number of undocumented Afghan migrants or the lack of access to healthcare. Erzurum officials said any unregistered refugees would be arrested. The United Nations says Turkey is hosting around 4 million refugees, 3.7 million of whom are Syrians fleeing conflict. Visiting Turkey in September, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, praised the government for what he called extremely positive policies towards migrants.
My visit here is also an opportunity to appeal to the international community, to donor countries, to international organizations to do more to help Turkey maintain these very generous policies for the refugees that it hosts.
Many Afghans say their status of refugees remains uncertain, so they prefer to live in the shadows as they seek a new life. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
The world's number one tennis player, Novak Djokovic, has won his case against deportation from Australia on the country's strict COVID-19 vaccination rules. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Novak Djokovic's fans celebrated Monday outside an immigration hotel in Melbourne where he'd been detained. Federal Court Judge Anthony Kelly said the Australian government's decision to cancel his visa was unreasonable. He said that the Serbian tennis star wasn't given enough time to speak with tournament organisers or his legal advisers after he was detained Wednesday at Melbourne Airport, a standard treatment for an unlawful non-citizen according to Australian law. He'd flown to Australia believing he had an exemption from the country's COVID-19 vaccination regulations, which state all foreign nationals entering the country must be fully inoculated or have a medical waiver. Djokovic said he'd contracted coronavirus in December, which gave him the right to apply for an exemption. However, Australian border authorities had said that the tennis star had not met immigration regulations and would be deported. But his lawyers told the court that the decision to revoke his visa was illogical, irrational and legally unreasonable. Immigration lawyer John Finlay told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that it was a hard case for the government to win.
This is the outcome I expected, yes. Mr. Djokovic's lawyers put a very compelling case. The main thing that the court was concerned about was the unfairness, the manifest unfairness to Mr. Djokovic about the way the officers at Melbourne Airport conducted themselves.
Djokovic has been released from detention and will likely be allowed to defend his Australian Open title. He's won the event 9 times. Should he triumph at this year's tournament, he'll become the most successful men's Grand Slam champion with 21 titles. However, Australian Immigration Minister Alex Hawke has the ability to intervene again and order his deportation. Under Australian law, the minister has exceptional authority and discretion to cancel a visa. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using 2 telescopes in Hawaii imaged for the very first time the final 130 days of a dying massive star before it blew up into a Type 2 supernova. According to a press release from the W.M. Keck Observatory, the red supergiant star had a mass 10 times that of our sun and located 120 million light-years away in a galaxy called NGC 5731. The supernova was named SN 2020 TLF. The star was first spotted by scientists with the Pan-STARRS system at the Haleakala Observatory in the summer of 2020 and were joined by colleagues at the Keck Observatory. Astronomers at both facilities spent a few months observing the dying star until its life ended with a massive cosmic explosion in the fall of 2020. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Adofo in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.